So I always start these things searching for a starting point. And what was occurring to me was that it would be good to go back to the Buddha before we start talking about the Dhamma revolution and the new society. So I'm sure that everybody's familiar, at least broadly, with the story of the Buddha's quest for enlightenment. You're familiar with the story of him becoming dissatisfied with the narrow and cramped conditions. He talked of it. This life, this worldly life, is narrow and dusty, he said. And he went in quest of truth, you could say. And very familiar story. He tried first all the time-honored methods of Hindu, or, well, pre-Hindu, early Indian asceticism. Various forms of extreme self-denial and so on. But he says at one point that he was down to one grain of rice a day. And then he says, in case you think that grains of rice were any bigger then, they weren't. They're the same size as they are now. And he realized that that was not getting him anywhere, except to a rapid end. And he had an experience remembering early in his life, even in his childhood, sitting under a tree while his father, according to some accounts, was ploughing, and just falling into a state that we would now referred to as meditation, as dhyana or samadhi. It's quite spontaneously, very naturally. And he realized that that state of great wholeness and mental positivity and alertness, was the way forward. And so he left the companions he'd been practicing extreme asceticism with, and plunged deeper into the jungle. And it's said that he arrived at a place called Uruvela at that time, which is of course now known as Bodh Gaya, in Bihar province, in Bihar state of eastern India. And I came back from there just a month ago. And he sat down underneath a Bodhi tree, as we now call it, a people tree, and he gained enlightenment. He saw the true nature of things. He saw that everything is conditioned, everything arises in dependence on conditions, and that therefore there can be no fixed eternal element, whether inside or outside, and that freedom lies in accepting fully that absence of fixity, embracing it fully, letting go of all clinging. And under that tree, completely alone, he freed himself, he was liberated. And the picture you get is of somebody very, very much on his own. He'd abandoned his home. We don't really know so much about his home, there are legendary accounts of it, but it certainly was a privileged background that he seems to have come from. He left his companions in asceticism, and they apparently were quite disgusted with him when he left them. And he plunged into the jungle very much on his own. And according to some later accounts, he spent 7 weeks in that area around the Bodhi tree, moving from place to place, from tree to tree, just musing on what he'd experienced, digesting his experience, to put it that way, if we can talk about what happened to him. It's said that the traditions give a rather schematic account of, you know, 7 weeks, each of which consists of 7 days. And in those 7 days he went through certain experiences. Well, seven times seven is so clearly a symbolic number. anyway, he spent a number of days in that area, sort of digesting what had happened to him. The first time that it had happened in human history. He had no reference points. He couldn't refer to anything that he'd learned. He couldn't refer to anything that anybody taught him. He'd been to teachers, but he'd gone beyond them. So very much alone. That's the picture you get. Quite striking when you go to Bodh Gaya, which is a pilgrimage site, but also a very much a tourist city. And tourist cities everywhere are not particularly attractive. They're particularly unattractive in India. Pilgrimage sites, beggars, a lot of the kind of very crude commercialism, and tour parties from all over the Buddhist world who are doing Bodh Gaya in 3 hours, and you can get trampled in the rush. A very busy place, and not a particularly attractive place. But when you actually get to the tree and sit under the tree, you can, I've certainly myself every time, had a deep experience of the solitude of the Buddha under that tree in the jungle at that time. Now it's, you know, an archaeological site with very ancient ruins all around it, the Mahabodhi temple reconstructed. But then it would have been just bare jungle, deep jungle. He says, on his own, under the tree. Hadn't seen anybody, probably for weeks. Just before he sat under the tree, a herdsman had given him a pile of grass, which he sat on. A milkmaid had given him some milk rice, just as nourishment. But apart from that, he'd been completely alone. He said for 5 weeks, he just stayed there alone, moving around from place to place. And according to the perhaps somewhat legendary accounts, but no doubt echoing something that did happen, on the fifth week, he sat under a tree, which is known as the Ajapala tree, the goat herd's banyan, which is in front of the Mahabodhi temple today. You can see the pillar, the Ashokan pillar, which marks that spot. He sat under that tree, and he saw somebody walking towards him for the first time. It's quite important, the first human being he'd encountered since his enlightenment. That person was a Brahmin priest. Now, if you know anything about Indian society, especially in more recent times, you know that it's a caste-based society, in which people are assigned, everybody has a place in a system of graded inequality, in which you have certain duties attached to you according to your birth, like a class system or any sort of a system of grading and that kind, although very, very intense and very complex and with strong religious underpinning. The Brahmins are at the top of that heap. Actually, in that area of India, at that time, they were trying to assert themselves. It was not yet a fully caste-based society in that area. But the Brahmins were sort of definitely asserting themselves as the superior caste, born from the mouth of the primal being, as it were, the superior beings. And so this encounter between the Buddha, 5 weeks after his liberation, with somebody who represented the dominant social group, is highly significant. The Brahmin approached him, seeing him there sitting under the tree, and asked him the key question of the time. He asked, what is it to be a Brahmin? In a way, what he's doing, reading between the lines and looking into commentaries and so forth, what he's doing is saying, I am a Brahmin, I'm at the top, you, sitting there with your religious pretensions, are nowhere. And very, very significant. The first encounter that the Buddha has with a human being is an encounter with the social order, the conventional society of his time, an encounter with the dominant social force of the time. And he very straightforwardly completely rejects the entire basis of that social order. He says, you're not born a Brahmin, because that's the essence of the system even today, that if you are born into a particular caste, regardless of your moral worth, then you stand in a particular position. And, you know, we can think of our own equivalents, whether it's class, race, whatever, gender, whatever. There are always these fixed hierarchical notions that believe very strongly in themselves, have their own ideology that supports them. And the Buddha, in rejecting this social hierarchy, you could say rejected all social hierarchy. He said, you are not born a Brahmin. What makes you a Brahmin? And here he's trying to redefine, if you like, a Brahmin. He said, what makes you a Brahmin is your moral quality. It's whether you are a decent human being. A bit like in 18th century Britain, saying, what is a gentleman? You know, because a gentleman, of course, was in a way a caste identity. And saying, well, no, it doesn't matter whether you're a worker, a peasant, a labourer, or a king. You're a gentleman only if you act in morally worthy ways. So the Buddha directly, immediately confronted the existing social order. I think this is extremely significant. And it's strange in a way that this is not really pointed out or drawn attention to. It's very, very striking that according to rather not exactly apocryphal, but they're not canonical, but accounts that are pretty early, the Buddha directly confronts the existing social order and asserts, instead of that existing social order, that existing social order's reliance upon the accident of birth as a determiner of status, it asserts a moral order, a moral status. And this is the beginning of Buddhism's encounter with the conventional societies of the world. Unfortunately, it has not always kept that encounter going in the spirit in which the Buddha began it. At times, of course, Buddhist traditions and so forth have compromised with the social order because, of course, the existing social order determines where you get your belly filled, status and so forth attached to supporting that social order. But again and again throughout Buddhist history, great leaders, great teachers have challenged the existing social order. Sometimes at cost to themselves, considerable cost to themselves. People have refused status in the palace. They've refused gold. They've refused privilege. And they've asserted a moral order, a spiritual order. So it's this that I want to talk about. It's what we talk about in India as the Dhamma revolution, a revolution in society that's based upon the Dharma, that uses the power of the Dharma to transform society, to transform the fixed and rigid hierarchies, injustices, the corruptions, the limitations, the narrownesses that again and again human beings construct around them, rejecting them and asserting in their place a moral order that's based upon human worth in terms of skillful action, to use the Buddhist terminology. A moral order that's based upon the qualities of your own mind, whether your mind is really in tune with the way things are or not. This is what Buddhism's again and again asserted. In India, our movement is, our Tri Ratna Buddhist order and community is strongly connected with a movement to reject the caste system, especially stemming from people who would formerly have been considered untouchable. I'm going to say more about this probably tomorrow, but we've coined this phrase, Dhamma Revolution, because we think there is a need to change things. The existing social order is not just, it's not fulfilling, it's not fair, you could say. It requires a constant challenge from a moral and spiritual perspective. It's not so very bad in a country like Britain, but it's still got its injustices, its limitations, its crudities, its narrownesses, its deadening qualities. And the Dhamma, it seeks to transform that. It's a very, very significant issue for us. And I'm very pleased to come back to this issue, partly because I spend 6 months of my time very much talking this language in India. Well, I was just boasting yesterday that I gave a talk to 2 million people on Lord Buddha TV in Nagpur. In fact, it was claimed that it was 8 million, but I'd be modest and say probably a 2. And, you know, I was doing what everybody else on that channel does, is talk about the way in which the Dhamma, when it's brought to bear on society, transforms it, or can transform it. It's not so present for us, probably. Well, it depends. You're so many people here. Different people will have different angles of approach. I know some who are very keen on this. It's certainly very, very important to me when I first became involved. And I remember that was very much an impetus behind founding this particular centre. We had a short life centre in Archway in North London. This was in 1973, 1974, 1975. And the council took back the centre to demolish it. It's now a housing estate. No blue plaque is there yet. But it's an old piano factory that made a very nice centre. But that was to be demolished. And they suddenly announced that we had to get out, I think within 5 months or something like that. So we had to look for a new centre. My responsibility was mainly to orchestrate that quest. And, we were mainly people a bit like me. In other words, white, middle class, university educated hippies who'd you know, done our national dope service, dropped our LSD, and found our way to Buddhism as a way of sort of continuing that very exciting inquiry. It's all old hat now, isn't it? Everybody smokes. But in those days, it was a sort of religious practice. You know, we were sort of, you know, I used to take LSD with the Tibetan Book of the Dead as my guide. Lucky to be here, frankly. So we sort of thought in terms of connecting with people like us. So we thought, well, let's look in Notting Hill. Let's look in Covent Garden, which at that time had just, the market had just closed. And, I go back a long way. And it was, you know, a redevelopment site. And we think, well, we can have a centre there. And this is a very happening sort of place. Middle Earth was there where the Pink Floyd played and all that. dating myself hugely moment by moment. I remember Psychedelphica Mania versus Ian Smith at the Roundhouse in Chalk Farm. So we thought in terms of sort of going where the alternative middle class white youth would be. And unfortunately, those sort of places were rather expensive and difficult to get to. And some of us had an idea that actually perhaps we should try to be a bit more adventurous, a bit more radical. And I can't remember how it happened, but yeah, that's right, we approached the GLC, RIP, and the Greater London Council. And they had a list of buildings that they were seeking tenants for. And on that list was the old fire station in Bethnal Green. I'd never been to Bethnal Green. I sort of knew of Bethnal Green as, bandit country. it was still at that time a thoroughly Cockney heartland. It was very much the old London working class heartland, the remnants of Pearly Queens and all that. It's astonishing when you think of it now. It's no longer just the place where Bengalis come. It's now a hippie. Yuppie. What's the word for it? Anyway, it's really cool now. It's astonishing. It was really far out at that time. I mean, not in the hippie sense. It was a long way down the line. But we thought, good. We should be getting out of our sort of social class ghetto and trying to take Buddhism where, in a way, you don't think of Buddhism going. And that was quite definite sort of inspiration behind being here. To begin with, a men's building team moved in here. At the height of it, I think there were 30 of us living upstairs. It was, up your neck in mud and bullets. It was like the trenches. It really was the National Service. It was grim and extremely exciting and horrifying and unbelievable naivety and terrible sort of misunderstandings and power struggles and, all the things that makes Sangha exciting. working it all out. I remember this very strange sort of sense that we class-bound England, most of us coming from a quite different sort of background, and trying to sort of really connect with the area we were in, and trying to sort of make connections and trying to find ways of thinking about how we might communicate the Dhamma. Actually, at that time, we were so concentrated on just getting the building done. Money running out, no skills, only one skilled man, Attila, who lives nearby, poor fellow, but pretty much did everything himself with everybody else getting in his way. But at the same time, this tremendous feeling that we were on some kind of mission, not from God, of course. And I remember the main exit was out through the front door, well, what used to be the front door, in, I don't know what it is now, the exhibition space, is it? And we used to go out through that door, which was just a plywood door on a battered bit of wood, as it were. And some wag had written on the door as you went out, "You are now entering samsara." And that, perhaps was a bit of the feeling that we had. Not exactly that it was nirvana in here, but that when you went out there, you were entering bandit country. And it was not just a class issue, but a sort of Buddhist elitist issue. And so we are now entering samsara. And that, you know, we all looked at that and giggled as we went out for 2 or 3 days. Then one day I came down and somebody crossed out entering and written transforming. You are now transforming samsara. And, I thought that was a quite important point. And in a way, my 3 days are going to be about what that really means, how a place like this is about transforming. Samsara is a rather big and much misunderstood word. Let's say we're transforming society. We're trying to contribute, not on our own, fortunately with others from different backgrounds, different viewpoints. We're trying to transform samsara. What we're doing is, what we're trying to do is do that on the basis of the Dharma. Not merely the Buddhist teaching, but the spirit, as it were, that the Buddha discovered in his enlightenment. We're trying to bring the power of the Dhamma to bear upon the world that we live in, just as we're trying to bring it to bear on ourselves. When you come here, you learn meditation, you learn mindfulness, whatever it is you learn. And of course, the accent is very much on taking responsibility for yourself, learning to transform your own mental states, learning to better your own communication, transforming yourself, bringing the power of the Dhamma to bear on you. But that is not enough. That is not enough, because we exist within a larger world which all the time is impinging upon us. On the one hand, defensively, so to speak, we need to transform the world. But otherwise, the world will transform us. It's very interesting. The Buddha did bring about this Dhamma revolution. He did subvert the Brahminical caste system. But that system reasserted itself. In Dr. Ambedkar's terms, I'll talk more about Dr. Ambedkar tomorrow. There was a revolution. The Buddha brought about a revolution, but there was a counter-revolution. The social order, the hierarchies, the structures, the system has its own ideas. It has its own ideology. Ideologies, and those will reassert themselves unless we are able to transform them. So it's not merely a question of altruism, although that is there too, very, very strong. Even from a defensive point of view, we need to make some difference to society so that it's possible to be a Dhamma practitioner, fully possible to be a Dhamma practitioner. Pretty free here now. But it's not everywhere free, and it won't always be free in this country, even this tolerant, the tolerance of indifference of Britain. It's not always going to be like that. So yes, in our own interest, we need to be making sure that there's space for the Dhamma. But we're not insensitive, insensible beings. We live alive to the world around us, to the people around us, and surely, when we look around us, certainly when you turn on the radio or watch the news anywhere, you see so much suffering. You know, there's famous Blake, isn't there? London. Everywhere, marks of weakness, marks of woe. On every face I see, marks of weakness, marks of woe. When you're alive to the world around you, yes, you see happiness, you see well-being, but you also see suffering. There's so much of it in this world. We're pretty privileged here, but around in this world, in this, whatever it is, billions of people, there are so many billions who suffer dreadfully. And we can't close our hearts to that. If we're trying to develop Maitri in the Metta Bhavana, we're trying to develop loving kindness, it's not compatible. If you open your heart and then encounter suffering, you need to have a response to it. Otherwise, you close down again, which means closing down your own spiritual development. So we need to bring the power of the Dhamma to bear upon the world around us so that it transforms us, just as we bring the power of the Dhamma to bear on ourselves and our own lives. It's a very, very evocative idea, isn't it? Bringing the power of the Dhamma to bear. But what on earth does it mean? What is this power of the Dhamma? Is it some sort of cosmic energy that we channel? It's not a bad metaphor, but it could only be a metaphor and got its limitations. What does it actually mean? What are we doing if we're trying to bring the power of the Dhamma to bear? Well, the best way I can think of discussing explaining this, I've gone into it in more depth and detail in the talk that is available outside. We're bringing the Dhamma's understanding of those possibilities within reality that can create a better experience for self, a better experience for others. We know that the Buddha taught that everything is conditioned, nothing is fixed, everything arises in dependence on previous conditions. I've talked about this every time in my rambles of late here, as I will carry on doing, because it's the heart of the Dhamma. Everything arises in dependence on conditions. This situation, I'm here because I was invited, because a train brought me here, etc., etc. Jnanavacha and others set up the situation. We're here because Attila put the place together. We're here because the GLC auctioned off an old fire station, etc. We're here because of a whole mass of circumstances. Each of you has your own conditions that have brought you here, some interest, some motivation that has brought you through the door. All these conditions combine to create this very moment right now, all its particularity, my voice hopefully reaching your brain, and you relating to that, engaging with that in whatever way you do. All of that is conditioned. But the Buddha said that totality of conditions obeys regularities. This is a straightforward scientific principle. You can detect particular flows within reality. The standard example that I repeat every time is the example of gravity. There's a regularity that bears a lighter body towards a heavier one. Goodness knows why. Then some explanation is given to that, some mathematical model is created for it, which is simply, as somebody famously said, a sophisticated statement of ignorance. But nonetheless, we know pretty much in most circumstances, if you drop something, it'll go down. And if it doesn't, you'll know that there are other conditioned regularities that determine what else happens. Magnetism, weightlessness, a thinned atmosphere, or whatever it is. So we can pretty much predict on the chemical, the physical, the organic level, how these conditioned processes arise. We can even see it with our own basic mental processes. We can see that if you put yourself under too much strain, you can't think clearly. How if you place a crepe Suzette in front of your mouth, in front of you, your mouth will water. I don't know why a crepe Suzette. Weird, the things that come up. No doubt there's some conditioned processes at work there. in India, I always mention a puran puri, which is absolutely delicious kind of dessert, and it's my way of making sure I get lots of them. things arise in dependence on conditions. You see. your own mind and your sort of perceptual system, your basic almost animal system, functions according to determinate laws, which perhaps we share with animals, a kind of level of zoology and animal physiology and psychology. But all of that is present in us. It's present in this situation. Our legs have carried us here. Gravity has borne us up. Chemical processes in some mysterious way have brought electrical currents. Oh, you know what I mean. I'm no scientist. But there are other very, very important regularities that are what the Dhamma is principally concerned with. We need to be concerned with gravity and photosynthesis and stimulus response and so forth, because we have that dimension to us. But what's most important for our human happiness and fulfillment are other kinds of regularity. The first of those kinds of regularity comes under the heading of karma, which probably most of you will be familiar with that term. Karma is the filing cabinet, if you see what I mean, of those processes that come into play when a self-conscious individual makes decisions. If you're aware of yourself, you become a moral agent. You decide to do things. And your decisions have an effect, of course, on what you do, and therefore on what happens, so to speak, back. But they also have an effect, according to the Buddha, they have an effect on your inner experience. I'm going to just touch on this so briefly that it won't do justice to it. But I'll do it by referring to an experience that I imagine everybody here has, because you've come here. I imagine that everybody here has meditated. You've all, for instance, done the Maitri Vikasa, what do you call it? Metta Bhavana, or the Anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing. Or maybe you've done some of the mindfulness training downstairs. And what you've seen in that is that when you make some kind of effort, even if it's an effort not to make an effort, so to speak, there's a change in your inner experience. So you sit down, you consciously think, may I be well, may I be happy, may I progress. And it may not be that there and then there's some change. I think quite often what you experience is a bit later in the day you suddenly feel full of warmth and full of well-wishing to others. But as you get more practiced at it, it's more likely to happen sort of more with you putting in the effort. So you make a karma. Metta, the desire for the well-being of self and others, is a karma, an action. And that action that you make, a mental action, has a consequence for your own mind. Your own mind emerges in a subtly modified way as a result of that karmic effort you make. So in meditation we've got a very clear illustration which most people will have experienced. If you've been on retreat, you get even stronger experience of this. It can be very, very powerful indeed. In the course of a week on retreat, or even a weekend on retreat, you're making effort again and again in your meditation sessions in very good surroundings. And when you come away, it can be quite astonishing. You almost feel as if you're a different person. I remember that so strongly coming off my first retreat. You feel as if you can conquer the world, as if the world is never going to have a problem again. Mm-hmm. Soon disillusioned. But you feel just so different. And you feel different, not just because you've been in a nice setting. That has an effect. Not just because you've been with nice people. You feel different because you've been developing skillful mental states. You've been consciously activating karma conditioned processes, which has modified your inner experience. That, of course, then has an effect on your external relations, your external interaction. You know, you get those astonishing experiences of developing metta towards an enemy, and the next time you see them, they're really friendly to you, when they've been beasts before. And nothing has sort of changed in the circumstance, but something about the atmosphere, as it were, that you have generated, and I don't think it's actually as sort of mystical as it sounds when you speak like that, but you just come from a different point of view, and that alters their responses. It's magic. But actually, it's not magic. It's natural. You're working with processes inherent in reality that are available to you all the time. And our Buddhist practice, to begin with, is chiefly about activating the power of karma. So when I talk about drawing on the power of the Dharma to transform self and society, I mean, in the first place, drawing on the power of karma. And we'll see how that plays out in society. But first of all, we need to recollect it, recognize it playing out in us. You don't have to be a Buddhist to operate with karma, of course. Good people everywhere, whether consciously or unconsciously, whether awarely or not, are working with karma. All good moral teaching activates karma. It asks you to develop positive mental states. The Buddha, in talking about this, famously in the Kalama Sutta, which is a very, very important sutta, sort of pretty much says, look, you know what is good for you and what's good for others. You know what a good action is. You don't need to be told it. You know that kindly states feel good, help you through life, and make other people, well, they're better for other people, and make them respond more differently to you. You know that. Just in the same way, you know that harsh, jagged states of mind are painful, and that they are not very pleasant to be around. You know that. So it's not rocket science. It's that kind of profoundly ordinary knowledge that isn't taught and that ought to be taught in schools. Seriously. Karma should be taught. Maybe it is in the best of situations. People should be learning about how our inner life unfolds. And according to Buddhism, and perhaps we can verify this in our experience, if we deliberately choose to select skillful mental states and try to hold down unskillful ones, our own minds change. They become more and more awake. You're more and more alive to what's around you. You're more and more sensitive. You feel more and more in tune with what's around you. You feel more and more that you're interacting with it, you're interflowing with it. You feel much more relaxed internally. It's direct changes that come through the putting forth of a moral effort. You are modified. I hope that everybody in their contact with the London Buddhist Centre has something of this experience. If you haven't, I'll need to speak to the chairman. It should be one of your predominant experiences. Of course, it's not all going to change overnight, because it's dependent on your effort. Unfortunately, there's no magic to it, only the magic of effort, of being aware of yourself and gradually learning in a healthy and constructive and natural way to select skillful mental states. And gradually your mind will emerge in a more and more relaxed, expanded, open, awake and loving way. This is where Buddhism starts. And a lot of our spiritual life, a lot of our Dhamma life, is to do simply with these processes. Simply evolving our consciousness by karma, by skillful mental states, skillful words, skillful actions. Actions based on love, on openness, generosity, on awareness, sensitivity, you could say, and actions that are moving away from hatred, from selfishness, grasping, and from ignorance, unawareness. If we gradually shift from the one to the other, our minds unfold in more and more subtle ways, we develop. Development is fueled, is powered by karma. But that power of karma is what, as Buddhists, we first of all need to apply to ourselves and what we need to apply to society. And it's that we'll be talking about tomorrow. How do we bring karma to bear in society? How do we bring the power of these naturally occurring conditioned processes to bear on the society that surrounds us, all, and not just here, but everywhere? How do we bring it to bear on British society? How do we bring it to bear on the economic system that we exist within? How do we bring it to bear on the various kinds of injustice that still exist here? How do we bring it to bear on the life of Dalits in India? How do we bring it to bear on, well, topically, on Roma in Hungary? I'm working with Roma in Hungary on this basis. I'm supporting some friends who are working in that sort of context. I don't want to claim very much myself. I'd love to, but I can't. How do we do that? That's part of the theme that I'm going to start in on tomorrow. But it's not all there is to the power of the Dharma. It's very important that we realise that there's something else that we're drawing on. It's very much more difficult to explain, very much more difficult to communicate. I haven't thought out how I'm going to do it. It's said that, let me talk theoretically, take refuge in theory to begin with. You can tell I'm an old philosopher. These conditioned processes we've seen in functioning on the natural, physical level and so forth, we've seen them operating on the karmic, moral level. But they operate on another level altogether. As you develop karmically, as your mind unfolds in a more and more subtle and skillful way, it becomes, as I've said, more and more interactive. You become less and less isolated. I think probably an experience that you commonly get in meditation and on retreat is more of a sense of being part of everything, not being so isolated and separate. You feel that you're more connected to everything around you. In other words, the tension of I is gradually relaxed. You feel more friendly, you feel more part of a community, you feel more in tune with the natural world, you feel part of nature, you could say. And this process continues through karmic action to the point at which you actually see that in a very deep and radical sense, you are not at all separate. You're not at all separate. There isn't a fixed, isolated, eternal soul, Atman in the Indian tradition. There isn't something that a metaphysical entity that somehow beyond it all is independent and separate. You see that actually all the experiences that you sense within you are chains that are part of everything around you, that arise from them, flow back into them. And you let go of your clinging. You let go of your fixity, this defensive self-attachment. And it's not that at that point it all goes blank. It's not that at that point, you just enter a sort of a desperate state of loss of individuality. You become a kind of sheep. I live in the middle of a sheep field, so I know what that means. What happens then is a stream of mental states arise within you, but which are not at all selfishly based, that don't ultimately refer to I. They don't sort of deny this end of it either. They arise within you and they lead you into a deepening interconnection with others. They lead you into compassionate activity. They lead you into activity that helps others to find freedom, in whatever terms one wants to speak of that. They're creative acts. You act like the artist in the moment of greatest creativity. It's often says, "I did not create that. I did not write that. I did not paint that." Abhayavajra was saying to me yesterday, the caretaker at Vajrasana, some of you will know, is a painter, and he was saying to me that there are those moments when he's been painting and he doesn't know how what was there got there, and he knows that what is there is really wonderful. It's not good enough, of course. You wouldn't be an artist if it was. But it's something that he couldn't explain how it came from him. It arises from some reservoir of consciousness that is not narrowly selfishly based. And according to Buddhism, our spiritual life, our Dhamma life, takes us to the point at which these states unfold within us more and more frequently, to the point at which they become the keynote of our life, to the point at which we are those states. We enter the stream of the Dhamma, we become a stream entrant. What's meant by stream entrant is someone who enters the stream of conditioned states arising spontaneously. They don't come from somewhere else. It's not that they come from some god or whatever. We don't need to think like that. It's not necessary to interpret them in that way. That's simply a thought that we impose upon them. In a way, it's simply enough to say they arise. And they arise without a self-reference. Someone like the Buddha became entirely free of self-reference. So everything he did simply manifested the Dharma, manifested the truth, manifested compassion, manifested these states of consciousness which flowed. They're not static, they're not fixed, but they flow through him into the world, you could say. And transforming the world means allowing those states, those transpersonal states, transcendental states, transcending greed, hatred and delusion, the denominators of selfishness, allowing those states to flow into the world and to affect the world, transform the world. One of the things I've very much connected with in India, working there, this movement of conversion of people who are formerly considered untouchable, under the impetus of their great leader, Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, who converted to Buddhism, came from that section of society himself, and became a very great political leader. He wrote the Indian Constitution. And he, at the end of his life, became disillusioned with political processes and converted to Buddhism, considering that it was the Dharma, in the end, that could transform society. And one of the most impressive things about Dr. Ambedkar is his unselfishness. He's a highly idealistic man. At the same time, a very, very brilliant man. Studied at LSE, had in the end three doctorates. Extremely intelligent, well-read, highly educated, very competent man, very skillful man, a very brilliant leader, brilliant writer, brilliant thinker. And he could have had anything. Even though he was from an untouchable community, he could have had anything. He was brought into the British Viceroy's council before the British went. He was brought by Nehru and Gandhi, with Mountbatten's backing, apparently, into the cabinet of the independent India. A quite extraordinary man who could really have had anything he wanted. He died in relative, not poverty, but without anything. He'd used all his resources for the sake of his movement, of his people. There are many, many stories of exceptional kindness, gratuitous kindness. Getting up in the middle of the night to help an old lady whose husband, you know, from his untouchable community, had not been admitted to a hospital because he couldn't pay. Getting up in the middle of the night, in the midst of the height of his political career, to go and pick this old man up, take him to the hospital, force the doctors to treat him. Just a little illustration. I've got so many stories of this kind. And what you start to realise is that you can't explain somebody like Dr. Ambedkar in narrowly ordinary terms. There's something about him that's more than ordinary. I think of this. I read an account of the life of John Milton, written by his son-in-law, I think it was, who wrote that he never met anybody who could with certainty ascribe motives to Milton's actions. In other words, a great creative individual like Milton was too big for our ordinary interpretation. You know, the way we always explain other people in terms of ourselves. Oh, he's doing this because. What else are we going to do? Really, our explanations of other people's awfulness is a description of our own. We limit people, but you know, we can only see them in terms of ourselves. We reflect onto them our self-interpretation. And a man like Milton in the creative sphere, which really links up, went beyond that. Somebody like Dr. Ambedkar, he way beyond his setting, his environment. You can't explain him in the usual Indian political terms. You know, an extraordinary thing about him, nobody ever accused him of corruption. Now, everybody in the politics in India is accused of corruption, mostly quite justly. It's just de rigueur, or what is called misconduct. And you know what that means. Everybody's accused of it. Even Manmohan Singh, who's probably not corrupt, or certainly not in misconduct. It's just normal. Nobody ever accused Dr. Ambedkar of that. You couldn't. It just wouldn't stick. Like sort of trying to blot out the sun or something like that. So what do you explain him by? Well, all you can say is something was going on within him that's more than the ordinary ego-based consciousness. How it arose, we don't know. The previous life, just his efforts in this life, whatever. Something, under certain conditions, gave rise to something that went beyond the ordinary ego-based consciousness. And that is what the world needs. It needs it on, of course, the grandest scale. People like Dr. Ambedkar. people like our own teacher, I believe, is plugged into that. I believe our movement comes out of that. Well, of course, our movement does, because it comes out of the Buddha, ultimately, and the great teachers of the past. But they were plugged into something, to put it like that, that metaphor. They were motivated by a stream of mental states that went beyond the self. That is what we need to mediate. We need to enable the Buddha's consciousness, if you like, to touch the world. That's what this centre is doing. When you come here, you're coming in contact with the Buddha, you know, in our inadequate way. A bit like, you know, a beautiful piece of music being played over a really bad transistor. Oh, do you remember transistor radios? Whatever it is you have nowadays. You have nowadays, you young people. You know, but even through the crackles and the pops and the whizzes and the wheezes, you can hear something intensely beautiful. So we need to mediate that as best we can. That's what a centre like this is trying to do. It's trying to bring that consciousness into your lives and thereby into the lives of others. And it's trying to not only bring that consciousness into your life, we are trying to bring that into our own minds. We are trying to transform our own minds so that they are motivated in that sort of way, so that they transcend that selfish motivation that still drives us. So the power of the Dhamma, ultimately, is the power of this non-ego-based willing, this stream of volition that does not come back, circle back onto I. That is what bringing the power of the Dharma into transform society means. So, we need to bring the power of the Dharma to bear on society by bringing karma to bear on society, bringing karma to bear on the world. We'll try to see what that means. But especially we need to bring the power of the Dharma to bear on the world by bringing this non-egoic volition, these streams of mental activity, these streams of willing that are entirely compassionate, that have no circling back to self, no ultimate self-interest. You know, I'm speaking to you, I'm trying to bring the Buddha to bear on you, but of course I'm concerned that you'll all think I'm brilliant, that I'm giving a really wonderful talk, and that you'll all give me a lot of chocolate afterwards, and even Crepe Suzette. You know, joking apart, you know, I'm interested in myself, as well as the Dhamma, and communicating that. Let's be honest about it. But, you know, we need to be getting to a state of mind where that is not there, where what comes is just a pure non-egoic volition. That is what can transform the world. The Buddha has had an incredible effect upon the world. And, well, we need to do our best to make that effective, but we need to do our best to be like that. So, that is that introduces my theme. Tomorrow I will go into you know, at least some model for what that might mean, where we might need to put our attention in order to make that happen. And the last evening I'm going to talk about really how we create the conditions for us so that we can do that. Just as here we had you know, something of a spiritual community from which we could go out to transform samsara. So we'll talk on the last day about that. I hope this has got my theme going, and that you've got some flavour of what the issues are. And please do come back tomorrow. If you can't come, go to Free Buddhist Audio. It'll be out within minutes of the end of this talk. Well, hint, hint. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow and rambling further into transforming society. Even what we're doing now, even encountering these ideas, is a revolutionary act. Good. I'm trying.